This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hello, I'm Alex Smith. For the coming months, we added dozens of new college and community radio stations to this broadcast, at least 50 more stations. As you may know, Daphne Wysham and her Earthbeat Radio crew are taking a break while they reorganize. Even while off duty, the reporter and Daphne never takes a break. Later in this program, you'll hear her on-the-spot recording from a tornado-ripped town in the hill country of Virginia. It's reality radio with a vision of what we can expect in the coming climate-damaged world. But we'll start with our feature interview. David Lochbaum is an American nuclear engineer, whistleblower, and expert for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Lochbaum warns reactor design and unreliable cooling systems, along with poor oversight, leave Americans with the same risk of multiple meltdowns experienced at Fukushima, Japan. We'll talk about how to make U.S. reactors safer for all of us. Then you get the latest from famous environmentalist Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. You may believe in Gandhi. I do. Watson says nonviolence can never stop pirates of the sea. He saved seals, dolphins, turtles, sharks, and whales right from his early days in Greenpeace to Sea Shepherd's latest campaign in the Antarctic, where they risked their lives to stop Japanese whaling. Now Paul has become a policeman for small countries plundered by foreign fishing fleets. He's headed for Libya. I recorded Watson's speech following the premiere of a new full-length biofilm, Eco Pirate, The Paul Watson Story. Don't miss the lively questions from the enthusiastic audience. Meltdowns, storms, and ships crashing together on the high seas, this is Radio EcoShock. This is Alex Smith asking, what really happened at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident in Japan? Could a similar problem happen in American reactors? What have we learned from the Japanese disaster that could make all nuclear power plants more safe? It's so hard to get reliable information. Can we trust the government or nuclear plant operators? Our guest is a nuclear engineer with 17 years inside nuclear power plants. When he called out a safety problem in 1992, going all the way to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, David Lochbaum finally got one thing fixed at one plant. Since 1996, David has worked with the Union of Concerned Scientists as an expert in nuclear power safety. In 2009, he spent a year training nuclear operators in an NRC training center. All through the Fukushima nuclear disaster, David Lochbaum and the UCS provided the best independent assessments to the media. On May 13th, he testified to a congressional subcommittee, pointing out five key weaknesses in American reactor operation that must be fixed to reduce the chance of meltdowns in the U.S. David Lochbaum, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alex.
David, I know you finally have the reports of the first few minutes of what happened after the Fukushima Daiichi was hit by that earthquake, but I would like to start with your testimony to Congress. I found it chilling. I couldn't believe we had so many weaknesses in the system. To start with, should we be confident that a similar accident just couldn't happen to an American reactor?
No, American reactors are basically the similar design. They're controlled by very similar regulations, and they face similar challenges to Fukushima. So while the exact scenario might be slightly different, there is a similar hazard that we need to address.
And in fact, there was a problem of a blackout that could have gone that way that you told Congress about. Could you tell us about that?
There was a incident back in June of 1998 where a tornado struck the Davis-Besse nuclear plant outside of Toledo, Ohio. That tornado knocked the normal supply of power, the electrical grid, out. So the plant's emergency diesel generators automatically started and were providing electricity to the essential equipment needed to cool the reactor. This occurred in June when the outside air temperature was above 90 degrees. About 26 hours later, the room temperatures in where the diesel generators were operating heated up to the point where the diesel generators failed due to high temperatures. Fortunately, an hour earlier, the workers had been able to restore one of the off-site transmission lines, so they got power back to the plant just before the diesel generators failed. So fortunately, there was an overlap instead of a gap.
And how long can you have a blackout situation like that before the fuel rods melt and you go into meltdown?
most of the reactors in the United States are designed for a blackout of 4 hours. 11 of our reactors, roughly 10%, are designed for a blackout lasting 8 hours, like Fukushima. When conditions last longer than that, then you start a meltdown clock that wasn't met at Fukushima. 3 reactors melted down. So you prefer not to beat the clock in that scenario.
So many of our, we're sort of getting into your testimony already, but many of our reactors in the United States do not even have, well, they have half the battery protection that was in the Japanese plant.
That's correct. The duration, whether you're a 4-hour plant or an 8-hour plant, is based on the severe weather conditions likely in the location of your plant, how reliable your backup generators are, and a number of other factors. And again, 93 of our 104 reactors are 4-hour plants, and only 11 are 8-hour plants. But you know, even 8 hours wasn't enough for the reactors at Fukushima.
So what did you recommend to Congress?
Rather than anybody waving a magic wand and say you need X number of hours of battery capacity, what we recommended was look at each site individually and see how long it would take to get the cavalry there, replacement batteries or portable generators. If that time for the cavalry to show up, the replacements to show up, is less than your existing battery capacity, then you should be fine. However, if it takes longer to get the replacements there than your batteries will last, one of two things needs to happen. Either the battery capacity needs to be added, supplemented, so that there's not a gap, or safety equipment, replacement equipment, needs to be pre-staged closer to the site so that they can get there before the batteries are exhausted. So I don't think it's a one-size-all solution. It depends on the site and what resources are available to that site.
All right. Well, in your second point, David Lochbaum, you told Congress the plans for managing a severe accident are never checked by the NRC inspectors. Could you explain that?
Yeah. After the Three Mile Island accident, the NRC required plant owners to come up with severe accident management guides. So if an accident wanders off script and things get worse than the emergency procedures called for, there were severe accident management guidelines that were supposed to help the operators deal with those unexpected situations. The owners of nuclear power plants are required to have these severe accident management guidelines, but the NRC inspectors are required never to look at them. That's something the NRC's decided years ago. For a while, I was an instructor for the NRC, and I taught the severe accident management guidelines to NRC inspectors, but I prefaced every class by saying, you're not allowed to evaluate these at your respective sites. That needs to change. If you're going to take credit for them, we need to know now if they have missing steps or missteps, because it's too late during an accident to find out that the procedures you're following are flawed.
David, I was shocked at the amount of spent nuclear fuel and some live fuel at reactor number 4 at Fukushima Daiichi. That looked like a real problem. But apparently that's nothing compared to what is sitting around in American reactor spent fuel pools. What are the problems you outlined with the spent fuel handling when you talked to Congress?
Well, the spent fuel is a hazard. And unfortunately, the hazard is stored in wet pools that are up in the attics of that type of design, of which there are 31 similar reactors in the United States. In that design, there are no backup systems. There are no robust 4-foot-thick concrete walls around it. So there's an increased likelihood that you're going to have an accident because you don't have the same level of backup systems as the reactor core gets. In addition, if there is an accident in the spent fuel pool, there's a greater likelihood that the radioactivity released from it will go far and wide and put a lot of people in harm, because the spent fuel pool is not housed in a robust containment building like the reactor core is. To make it even worse, in many U.S. reactors, there's 10 times as much fuel in the spent fuel pool as in the reactor. So that's a hazard, an accident waiting to happen, and we need to do something to fix that.
And one of the somethings you suggested was that we put more into dry cask storage. Did that work at Fukushima where it was in dry cask storage?
Yeah, it's not discussed a lot, but there were about 400 fuel assemblies, irradiated fuel assemblies, spent fuel assemblies that were in dry cask at Fukushima. There's very little discussion of that because there's not a hydrogen explosion or it hasn't melted down. They don't have to dump water on it from helicopters. It's not 100% safe, but it's much, much safer than fuel that's stored in wet pools because there's not much that can go wrong. We have about 25% of the spent fuel in the United States is in dry cask. but 75% of it's not in dry cask yet. We need to accelerate the transfer of spent fuel into dry cask to lower both the security threat and also the safety threat from that storage.
And why don't plant operators do it? Is it just the expense?
The expense is part of it, but also, to be fair to the owners, they were told, in fact, they signed contracts with the federal government saying that the federal government would start taking that fuel in January of 1998. It's now more than 10 years later, and the government hasn't taken any of that fuel. So the owners made plans based on what their contracts with the federal government said, and then the federal government reneged. They're somewhat reluctant to spend a whole bunch of money to deal with an interim plan for 10 more years when it's a moving target. They don't know what the federal government, when and where they're going to take that fuel off their hands. So part of this is the federal government's inability to deal with the storage problem, the long-term storage problem.
For Radio EcoShock and EarthBeat, I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is David Lofbaum, an expert on nuclear power plant safety. We're looking into lessons from the triple meltdowns at Fukushima, Japan, to see how American operators could upgrade their own safety and protect all of the public. I know you were piecing together the first official charts and records, but can we start with your overview of what we now think really happened at that Japanese accident in the first critical hours and days? Let's spend a little time on that, if you will, and tell us, what do we know now?
Well, shortly after the earthquake occurred, the normal supply of electricity was lost to the Fukushima plant. There were three reactors operating at the time. The earthquake took away the normal supply of electricity. The reactors automatically shut down as designed when they detected ground motion caused by the earthquake. The emergency diesel generators, which are the backup supply of electricity for the plants, automatically started on all the units, and for the first 45, 46 minutes were providing power to the essential equipment needed to cool the reactor core. Then the tsunami arrived. The tsunami waters disabled the emergency diesel generators, which took away the backup supply of electricity to the plant, and that left the plant with only the power available from banks of batteries on each of the units. For units 2 and 3, there's a steam-driven system that's capable of being controlled by those batteries, and it appears that on units 2 and 3, that steam-driven system was being used to provide makeup water to the reactor core for cooling. Unit 1 was an older reactor and didn't have that system. It had what was called an isolation condenser instead. The isolation condensers are just very large tanks of water. Steam from the reactor is routed through metal tubes inside those large tanks of water. The steam gets cooled down, converted back into water, and then drains by gravity back into the reactor vessel. The operators put the isolation condensers on Unit 1 into service, but for some unexplained reason, when they did so, that caused the cool down rate of the water inside the reactor to cool at a much faster rate than safety dictates. The water's inside a large tank or large metal pot called the reactor vessel, and to prevent the metal of the reactor vessel from breaking due to excessive expansion or contraction, you limit the heat up rate and cool down rate to 100 degrees Fahrenheit per hour. After the workers put the isolation condenser on Unit 1 in service, their cool-down rate was almost 300 degrees Fahrenheit per hour. So 11 minutes later, they took that system out of service and basically were left with no cooling on Units 1. When the batteries were depleted, basically all three reactor cores were left without cooling, and then it was only a matter of time before they overheated and melted.
And could you tell us just a little bit about the detailed reports that you've just received that you're going over?
About a week ago, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, posted on their website a bunch of data from the reactors themselves. They put copies of the actual paper chart recorders, so they're in the control rooms. They put the printouts from the computer alarm typers. They put the operator logs, and they put some parameters plotted from high-speed data recorders, which are kind of like the black boxes for aircraft. They put all of that information, some 1,900 pages of information, on the TEPCO company's website. I spent a couple days going through that data, trying to evaluate what happened, when, and why. Prior to going to work for UCS, I'd worked in the nuclear industry, and one of my jobs was to analyze events at plants using very similar data for very similar purposes.
I know these are still early days and you only have the beginnings of the information that you need, but so far, with your expertise in training nuclear operators for an accident, does it appear the TEPCO workers did the right things following the earthquake?
It did appear so. The available data only goes for the first 80 minutes, which is hours before the cores melted down. During that time period, it looks like the operators were following the emergency procedure scripts. They put cooling systems in service when they were supposed to do the functions that were necessary. As nature took more and more of those options away from them, they were left with fewer options to deal with the situation they had on hand. But in the period I looked at, it appears that the operators were doing what they were supposed to when they needed to do it.
And David Lochbaum, as you know, people living near reactors within earthquake zones in the United States are nervous, and I'm thinking of California, for example, or even in New York. Do you see any indications that essential equipment or the building itself was damaged by the earthquake rather than the tsunami?
That was actually one of the primary reasons for going through the data. We'd heard reports that some of the piping and some of the structures were damaged by the earthquake before the tsunami arrived. We didn't review every bit of data. That even though they put a large amount of data available, they didn't provide everything. But from the large amount of data we've reviewed so far, we don't see any signs that the structures or the piping failed before the tsunami arrived. I can't conclusively rule it out yet, but we don't see anything yet that points to that having happened.
And there have been theories as well that the building at Reactor 4 might have been damaged by the quake, or even that the fuel pool might have started leaking due to the quake rather than anything that happened during the tsunami. Any ideas on that one?
That's possible, but again, none of the data I've reviewed so far conclusively says that occurred. It still looks like the bulk of the damage was done when the hydrogen that collected inside the building exploded. There might have been damage before that, but I haven't seen anything yet that would allow me to swear to that.
Fair enough. Our guest is David Lochbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists. David, most of the world was shocked when the Japanese authorities finally admitted 2 months after the accident that all three reactors had melted down at least within 48 hours of the quake and tsunami. Why did it take so long? And I have to say, too, surely the Japanese authorities and I think the American government and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they must have known all along these reactors had melted down in the early days. What are your thoughts on that?
I think a number of reasons led to that delay. First of all, that when the tsunami hit and then the batteries were depleted, a lot of the instruments and the computers and the other things that collect data that would have made a post-event analysis easier to do were lost. Once the batteries were gone, all the computers, everything was dead. So their ability to piece together data, do the forensics to figure out what happened and why, was severely hampered by the data loss or data unavailability. Also point out that after the Three Mile Island accident melted down in 1979, it took the Americans almost 4 years to figure out that happened. They knew there was extensive fuel damage. That was known the first week. But it wasn't really known that the top half of the core had melted until a camera was lowered down from above and didn't see anything until it reached about 4 or 5 feet below where the top of the core had been. Then they found melted debris and a rubble bed where the core had been. And so it took us 4 years to figure out that Three Mile Island had melted down. So it's hard to fault the Japanese for taking 2 months to reach the same conclusion.
I'm still not reassured, I have to tell you. I've seen a report, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name, of another American nuclear scientist who sent a report to the IAEA saying that by his calculations from what was known that the reactor must have melted down in at least one case. And, there's just been statements made by the Japanese to Korean television that all three reactors were punctured. They said that in late March. It just seemed like there was such a rosy view of it's not too bad and 55% of the fuel is still good and we can fix it. And there's a lot of distrust has built up for governments and nuclear plant operators out of this accident. So I don't want to go on and on about that, but what I would like to do is say, how can we make this better if an accident does happen in America? How can we know that we're getting transparency, that the public is getting informed what they need to know to protect themselves?
The one thing we that's done to try to address that issue is every 2 years, every nuclear plant in the country has to go through an emergency exercise where they simulate a very bad accident, and they evaluate how well the plant owner plus the local, state, and federal authorities would work together to protect the public from the consequences. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission comes in and evaluates or grades how well the plant owner deals with that situation. FEMA comes in and evaluates how well local, state, and federal authorities discharge their responsibilities. That exercise, that process isn't foolproof, but I think it does go a long ways towards getting people prepared for that day should it arrive. I'd like to circle back to one point about the Japanese. While they may have taken a while to figure out that the reactor core, or to publicly announce that the reactor cores had melted down, they actually took steps to evacuate people who were potentially in harm's way fairly early on. So it's not that they waited until they made that call before they took steps to protect the public. They ordered an evacuation out to 12 miles in the very early day or second day, very early on in the accident. So they weren't waiting for that meltdown paper, rock, scissor game to make those kind of calls.
Okay, well, we're starting to run out of time. I'm wondering what you would like to talk about. What would you like to tell our listeners?
Well, if we could get just one thing done in the fairly near term, I'd like to see the spent fuel pools, which are basically filled to overflowing, get the radiated fuel transferred from the spent fuel pools into a dry cask. That would significantly lower the safety and security threat at these plants. It's basically a no-brainer. We knew it before 9/11. It was emphasized after 9/11. It's resurfaced now after Fukushima. We really need to stop talking about that safety fix and actually implement it.
What kind of timeline would that take? Let's say that, everybody agrees that's what needs to be done. How long would it take to get to a safer level?
Bob Alvarez at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. issued a report just this past week that answered that question. He looked at it and estimated it would cost for the entire fleet of reactors in the United States approximately $3.6 billion and would take about a decade. He pointed out in his paper that $3.6 billion seems like a lot of money, but when you compare that to what Fukushima is paying for not having done that, it's a pretty cheap insurance.
Have you had any feedback from the NRC about whether the plants will be adding more battery power or whether more training will be put in as far as handling spent fuel pool accidents?
Right now, the NRC is in the middle of a two-phase approach to answering those questions. They've got their quick look, 90-day review, is due up in mid-July of this year, followed by a longer-term approach that's due sometime next year. It already looks like they're seeing that there are issues involved with both backup power sources and with spent fuel storage. It looks like those issues will be addressed in some form or manner. But I think there's many more lessons, emergency planning, communications. There was a disconnect between what the U.S. recommended for U.S. citizens around the plants. They evacuated out to 50 miles. The Japanese only evacuated out to 12 and then 19 miles. So I think there's some collateral issues that need to be resolved, some within our borders, some we have to work with our international partners.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been David Lochbaum. He's an experienced nuclear plant engineer. He's worked in U.S. nuclear plants. He was a safety whistleblower, and he has been the director of Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Get more reliable and expert information from their website at www.uscusa.org. David, we really appreciate all the work you've done for the public. It has been super, and thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you, Alex, for having me on.
The question of whether the earthquake damaged the Fukushima Daiichi reactors is critical for U.S. reactors and American-designed reactors around the world. The Japanese press carried stories quoting plant operators TEPCO, saying critical reactor piping may have broken in the actual quake and not in the following tsunami. This was reported by Kyoto May 26th. Why does that matter? If true, it means any nuclear power plant could melt down due to an earthquake without a tsunami. For example, the Indian Point reactor north of New York City, which is on a fault line but away from the sea. Or the El Diablo reactors in California, which claim to be too high for a tsunami to hit. A large part of the world nuclear industry would be at risk. At a press conference, TEPCO said pipes leaking right after the earthquake could explain sudden temperature changes in reactors 1 and 3. In our interview, David Lochbaum, poring over 1,900 pages of data in just 2 days, does not yet see evidence of this. David does not say quake damage is not possible, but he hasn't seen convincing evidence so far. It really is too early to tell. Hardly any on-site inspections have been done because workers cannot even approach the reactor buildings. Heavy rains, sure to come with more tropical storms, may cause yet another disaster for the sea. Finally, radiation is flowing everywhere in that region of Japan. Even the snow and river fish are now testing as highly radioactive. This nuclear nightmare is happening so fast it can hardly be measured, be known, or be understood. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock and EarthBeat. I'm Alex Smith, trying to fill your ears for the planet and for coming generations. If you are new to this space, keep in mind we are filling in for that fine American green news program, EarthBeat, while Daphne Wysham and her crew reorganize. After 8 years on the air, Daphne deserves a break, but we need her back as one of America's top environmental reporters for nonprofit radio. Keep in touch with the website, earthbeatradio.org. Many of us are graduates from the Greenpeace School of Nonviolent Environmental Action. Paul Watson came from the Canadian Coast Guard to help the earliest Greenpeace anti-whaling campaigns. He put himself between harpoons and the gentle giants. He stood with the visionary Greenpeace founder Bob Hunter in front of a moving icebreaker off Canada's east coast to stop that infamous seal hunt. Watson became frustrated, wanting to go further. Bearing witness in the Quaker tradition was not enough, he said. Here is my report from the opening of a new film about his life and adventures at the far edge of environmentalism.
I'll do everything I can to protect whales and the other beings in the ocean. Not for people, but for them.
What would you do to save the animals and the ecosphere? How far would you go? Paul Watson says humans are a violent and dangerous species. The environmentalist and early founder of Greenpeace in Vancouver went to the edge of violence to save seals, dolphins, and especially the whales from human slaughter. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and EarthBeat. I've just seen the premiere of a new film biography, Eco-Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. We see young Paul on a dying whale, standing pat in front of an advancing icebreaker, ramming a rogue whaling ship and taking on the Japanese whaling fleet year after year in harsh Antarctic waters. Writer and director Trish Dolman spent years on the ships of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. She includes the harshest critics in her film, making this the definitive biography of one of the Earth's greatest environmentalists.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
The latest from Paul Watson and Trish Dolman coming up in just 1 minute from Radio EcoShock and EarthBeat.